The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to fund manager Graham Campbell of River Global. So welcome, Graham.
Hi, nice to speak to you.
Yeah, well, we've got quite a few sort of cross currents in the markets at the moment. We've obviously got the ongoing war in Ukraine and now the Middle Eastern crisis, offset by falling inflation and the expectation of declining interest rates and bond yields later on in the year. So putting all that together, what's your sort of like your view of global equities for the rest of 2024?
Actually, we feel reasonably optimistic. And the reason for that is that, I guess, last year, we're all very concerned that rising interest rates, could they go too far? Will inflation be very, very persistent? But this year, the debate is much more about when will rates fall and how fast they could fall. And I think that's very positive for sort of medium-term investor sentiment, because falling rates would suggest that growth will pick up again. And we've been looking for businesses that will benefit from that growth.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a real feature of your, sort of fund investment strategy. You know, you're prepared to look multi-decade rather than sort of flavor of the month. And I did notice running through the sort of 40 sort of focus positions you have in your portfolio, you've got no major Mag 7 or AI, but you have these really long cycle industries under three themes. You've got the recovery, you've got the replacement, and then you've got transformation with a capital R, haven't you? Can you just talk through that investment approach, particularly on the long-term view, that you're not looking for these short-term gains, but long-term capital appreciation?
Well, I think the first point is we have no visibility to forecast over the short term, and we don't believe anyone else has either. So if we can identify some of the longer term trends and identify the companies that will benefit from them, there's more chance of making a return for our investors. Historically, we've owned some of the big tech names, but as part of our process, we think there's a price you should buy something, but there must also be a price where they become overvalued. And we've owned things like, Apple and Microsoft. And somewhat annoyingly, we sold them too early, but we tend to be in early and out early because markets rarely stop at fair value in either direction. So we have owned these things historically, but we just feel as if they're very, very expensive. And it's a very crowded trade by the biggest companies in the world, also perceived to be growing the fastest, which I suggest is probably unlikely over the medium to longer term.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the fund seems to be, I speak to a lot of large cap global fund managers, and most of them are sort of quasi index trackers and are forced into these things. But it does seem as though, I mean, you're prepared to go against the grain, aren't you? You're sort of like, you sort of like invest what you think is the right thing to do rather than having to sort of catch up with a benchmark.
One of the benefits of a process is you have to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. And if it looks cheap and you recheck your numbers and recheck your assumptions, the question is, why aren't you buying it? Similarly, if it's very, very expensive, over the last couple of years with some of the tech names, which were often not profitable, what price would you sell these things? And many people said, well, they're good companies, they've got great prospects, but they wouldn't put a price onto it. And we think, we're looking to grow capital and grow income, but also, risk is very important and we want to conserve capital. So we focus on businesses with great long-term cash generation, with strong balance sheets, high margins, and low earnings multiples is what we're trying to do. And to go back to your question about why we're looking at these themes, that in recent years, companies have dealt with very difficult situations, particularly through the whole COVID period, when the outlook was uncertain. So virtually every company tried to conserve cash. They ran down the working capital. They didn't invest because they wanted to be sure they would survive until markets opened up again. When things opened up, we found a massive price hike because there was nothing in the system, no capex, and these so-called just-in-time delivery systems weren't delivering anything like just-in-time. So businesses have also had, other pressures on them, that there's pressures for their customers who are looking for more energy efficiency, automation, looking for renewable products. And I guess the positive is that companies, by conserving cash, have very, very strong balance sheets just now. So companies need to invest, but also they're able to invest. And we think that they will invest to, one is the replacement of assets. There are so many old assets. We see it in our own infrastructure, whether it's, you know, trains, schools, bridges, but also things like, you know, mining equipment, you know, tractors, all these sort of things. The age of the fleet has never been older. And there's pressure on businesses to reinvest for improved productivity, but also much more energy efficiency, and people are using much more automation to reduce further shortages of labour. So businesses that can identify these trends, can invest in the products to either, you know, deliver these goods to their customers, have been growing faster. And we expect this trend, particularly with that transformation, has a long way to go.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's go through two of those stocks, because they're certainly, you know, right in that sort of like sweet spot of sort of like, you know, electrification, reinvestment in sort of factories and infrastructure and stuff. Let's start with Schneider Electric, because I know it's moved also into sort of like not just the electrification and the decarbonization of the society, but also it bought Aviva, the software business, a few years back, and has moved much more into that sort of like a SaaS service of doing digital twins that allow companies then to build these big facilities. Can you talk through this one? Because it really looks like a perfect sort of GARP stock.
So, I mean, I think sort of, I guess the interest in this sort of transformation of these businesses, I mean, people often sort of try and analyze what they do, but in a very simple explanation, if you can imagine a sort of a building, a large building, previously heated with a variety of thermostats in every room, you know, and then if Schneider can have the switches to put the heating on and off, but then having the software to have data to then manage the whole project as efficiently as possible. So energy is there when it's required and not there when it's not required. And if you apply that to a large factory, you know, where you're measuring things thousands of times per second to improve efficiency, energy efficiency, but also to spot, you know, breakdowns before they occur, this software margin is very important. So these businesses before, when they made the switches and drivers, would probably earn a return of about 15% margin. But once they have the software, that's often a 30% margin. So these businesses, by doing this, are much less cyclical, much higher return, and they're much stickier with their customers, and they're growing much faster.
I mean, yeah, another one which is really sort of in that space and is a world-class sort of like, you know, beneficiary sort of picks and dribbles is Rockwell Automation, which I don't think has got quite as big a software, but it's got a big software component. You just mentioned that one as well, because it put out some results, I think, just recently, and it sort of did see some industrial destocking through its customers, but it said its demand outlook was very strong.
So it's a similar theme, you know, that we look at sort of Rockwell. We've also looked at, you know, Eaton in the US. And Rockwell's a smaller player, but it benefits from the same themes. Unlike a Schneider, which tends to own its own software, Rockwell has a sort of open source, so other software can work with their equipment. But it's, again, the same issue of looking at software and controls, and more manufacturers are looking to, you know, using, you know, data to massively improve the productivity. And, you know, software, and Rockwell said, well, short term, they've still got a very large order book. There has been some issues with supply, but you know, long term, their outlook is actually very attractive. We've used this weakness to pick up some more shares.
Yeah, and I guess both of those companies should be beneficiaries of AI because they control so much data for their clients, mass data and real time data, that they can then implement, presumably, AI technology on top to help their clients and get a better value-add wrap, I guess.
So, you know, I think the sort of people assume that AI just depends on the big tech companies. But actually, at an industrial level or for a consumer level, there's huge opportunities to, you know, some of the plants they'll control will be, you know, billions of dollars. And to make them a bit more efficient is real money, you know. So, but if, whether it's just for plant operating efficiency, but also ensuring that reliability also improves. And that's about using, you know, using measuring data, and then with AI adding to this will be massive benefits for them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to another adjacent sector, actually, into sort of like infrastructure and house building and stuff. Let's start with Heidelberg Materials, which I think is the world's biggest cement manufacturer and also sort of like does aggregates and stuff like this. I guess this is a sort of play on just global expansion and replacement of industry, of infrastructure, isn't it? Ports and, you know, airports and all this sort of stuff.
It's that, but there's more than that. I mean, sort of building anything requires really sort of steel or cement. And they both produce, both processes produce lots of CO2. Mm-hmm. So what happens with cement is companies are forced to buy carbon credits to offset the CO2 they use. Certainly, Heidelberg will benefit from the pickup in infrastructure spending. But also this year, they're going to be the first company to look at carbon capture. So basically, they're capturing the carbon from production and they're storing it in Norway, in a particular soil or particular structure. So that will be, they'll actually require to buy fewer carbon credits, but also the cement that is zero carbon, they can sell at a higher price. Plus, we'd sort of in the last 6 years, Heidelberg have been reducing their carbon usage from something like 601 kilos a ton to 550 kilos a ton. So the bigger companies have been able to invest to ensure the plants are more efficient and produce less carbon. And this gives pricing advantage as well. So I think there's a few factors there. Yeah. And, you know, given the sort of environmental issues, it's very difficult to build a new cement plant on anybody's doorstep these days. So, you know, pricing's going to be pretty robust and they'll throw off lots of cash in the next, say, in the next 5 years.
Are they changing their energy source then for their production? Is it moving to sort of like green or hydrogen or something like that?
They spent more from using LNG, these sort of things. So particularly, you know, in Germany, where there's been real concerns about, you know, Russian gas, they very quickly changed lots of their supply. So I mean, they're using the whole process to use less energy, be more efficient, and I think you'll see very strong cash generation from this business.
Yeah, and I guess let's be positive. When there is a resolution in Ukraine and it's got to rebuild, then I'm guessing Heidelberg's facilities and its sort of like cement are just going to be sold out for a decade, isn't it?
I think sort of everywhere. I mean, there's so much. You know, there's so much infrastructure work required everywhere that, you know, they also do road repairs as well. I mean, we all know the demand is phenomenal there. Yeah. If governments or councils would just spend the money.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, well, let's move on to sort of like, more in the housing side, but in sort of building, Wienerberger, which I think is probably one of the world's biggest sort of brick makers. It's certainly one of the top three in the UK after Ipstock and I can't remember what the other one is. It's certainly a big global brick maker, isn't it? And blocks and stuff like. Can you take us through this one? Because it's trading at a ridiculously low, well, less than 10 times PE with a pretty solid balance sheet, actually.
I think one of the huge opportunities is a business, you can see like a sort of Heidelberg or a Wienerberger. Historically, they were industrial cyclical businesses that in good times, they made a good return, but when things slowed down, they were barely profitable and a low margin. But actually with the sort of changes to Heidelberg, I think demand's going to be stronger for longer. And also with their changes to how they produce CO2, their products will be more in demand. So they'll be less cyclical. Also with Wienerberger produced a variety of products, whether it's bricks, tiles, plumbing. And one of the issues they've found is that their clients will say, when clients want to have lower carbon recycled products, but also we're short of plumbers and joiners. So can you design products that are more, the more they can be installed as one piece rather than all assembled on site? In the last 5 years, they've replaced around a third of their products. So the business has changed substantially, and these products are more energy efficient, more easy to install and use recycled products and improve energy efficiency. So as a result of that, we think the business will grow faster than its competitors, but also earn a higher margin and be less cyclical. And you would expect at some stage to be re-rated, which we don't believe has happened yet.
Yeah, well, I must admit, I'm a sort of... I've got sort of like a blindness to anything DIY. So if it's much easier to install on a sink or a pipe or anything like that, then that'll be sweet music to my ears. That's for sure.
A common thing, we speak to so many companies, and one of the biggest complaints is that, I guess, particularly post COVID, there's no apprentices weren't trained, and many of the important skills, joiners, plumbers, electricians, I've reached a certain age where they're about to retire, and there isn't the sort of younger group coming through. So it's important for companies to actually design products that require less of these skills.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. Okay, well, let's move to the final one in the infrastructure and house building. It's Saint-Gobain, which I think is your largest position, actually. It's sort of like does sort of construction materials and construction products and stuff like that. Can you just take us through this one? Because it's got a nice sort of like a 3% plus yield, strong balance sheet. Presumably, as you know, it's a beneficiary of all the long-term themes you just talked about.
So, and again, one of the sort of the attractions of Saint-Gobain is it has changed, that over the last sort of 5 years, they've replaced around 20% of their sales by selling out of low margin, low return businesses, buying much more sort of specialist businesses that are less cyclical, are much higher margin and much more cash generative. And despite these changes, the share price, it's performed pretty well, it's still on a relatively low, probably single digit year one PE. And their strength is often about using insulation and recycling insulation, because energy efficiency is largely about retaining energy, and this business is a global leader in this area, and we think there's a lot of growth driven by regulation and for customers wishing to reduce costs, and since Saint-Gobain is a prime beneficiary.
Yeah, I think you're exactly spot on. You raise a good point there in terms of both energy efficiency and sort of energy resilience, but also just supply chain resilience. So can you just talk through because I mean, both sectors, sort of like you've got the infrastructure plays and the electrification plays, which are all going to benefit from reshoring and nearshoring as well, aren't they? Because you've got your CHIPS Act and you've got your IRA, and you've got sort of like, countries even in Europe who are investing in new chip facilities and stuff like that. And it all going to require infrastructure and technology to be able to build these things.
Yes. I think it's very interesting was, you know, that if you go back sort of 5 or 6 years, people often looked at sort of ESG characteristics as potentially, you know, risks, because businesses that weren't doing certain things had risk of, you know, clear up or fines. But now it's much more about an opportunity. Businesses that are able to improve, you know, environmental, you know, energy efficiency are growing much faster. And we've tried to identify some, it may seem, you know, industrial businesses that have changed and management are investing much more in areas, you know, that help with, you know, efficiency, automation, and also nearshoring. We bought a Mexican bank last year, which is benefiting hugely from businesses moving from, you know, Asia or China, moving closer to the US, and there's a lot of plants being built in Mexico, which will help their lending growth substantially. So there's a fair bit of research will go into a business like that before we invest, but there are many opportunities driven by the factors that you mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's again to move to an adjacent market. Is sort of like mining equipment and sort of construction equipment. We've got Caterpillar, which I guess used to be the archetypal sort of like cyclical play, but because there's such a move now to renewables, you're effectively changing the demand dynamics for energy and power away from oil and gas long term to electrification, which presumably means, with the terms of mining companies, there's a whole new now requirement to do battery metal mining on top of all the traditional iron ore and copper. Is it everything else like nickel and cobalt? Can you just talk through sort of how you see Caterpillar? Because it has it lost that sort of cyclicality, and you know, in terms of, you know, where it is, it had a came off. It had a good 2022, very good 2022, and it had sort of like, I think it's a flat 2023. And what the sort of outlook is because you would normally expect in a cycle, if we go through a slightly softer economic, to go down, but it may not necessarily be the case now.
Well, I think sort of Caterpillar has an operating margin of over 18%, which is, you know, remarkably high.
Yeah.
And they've been developing it into much more into automation.
Yeah.
So the benefit from, as you said, that mining equipment has never been older. Plus there's demand to increase capacity for things like copper, nickel, and still iron ore and coal. So there'll be a replacement part to their growth. But also, I mean, some of these massive mines can take hours for trucks to get to the bottom of them and fill up and go back. This can be automated as well. So there's a software part to this. Plus, you know, you don't want to have a breakdown halfway down a mine. So you're having much more controls on the vehicles to diagnose any issues before they become a major issue. And Caterpillar has a very leadership position in many industries and already earns a very high operating margin and is well placed for this replacement and transformation cycle.
Yeah, no, it's only 15 half times PE, which is a bit of a surprise because it's the sort of the world's iconic yellow metal construction equipment manufacturer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move to a similar sort of business, but in the agricultural sector is Deere and Company, which obviously the John Deere sort of tractors and combine harvesters and stuff like that. Can you take us through this one? Because again, we've got sort of like long-term trends, I guess, of population and sort of like, you know, making sure that we can sort of feed the world and move to sort of like, you know, better farming in terms of less irrigation, more resilient sort of crops and stuff like that. But equally, I think the farmers, or they certainly around this neck of the woods, they've been a bit squeezed by input cost inflation, haven't been able to transfer that into selling price increases with the supermarkets.
I think sort of, you know, this is a business again where the fleet that is out with farmers has never been older, right? And there's a huge benefit from upgrading, because you know, one is there's a shortage of labour, and in some parts of the US where the sort of where the tractor will drive for sort of 5 hours in one direction, turn around in 5 hours in another direction. You can do that with automation, with without a driver. But I think more importantly, there's using data of mapping data, where they can say, you don't just plant, you scatter, whether it's pesticides or seed, equally in all directions. It depends on drainage with that site. It depends on elevation, slope, all these things. And John Deere can demonstrate that by using their software and then programming the tractor, they can use less pesticide, less seed, and have higher returns. And now that the business is the software business is now around 10% of sales, and once a farmer has made that transition, it's very sticky. But also, it means for the business, it's probably a much higher margin. I mean, in fact, in recent years, the operating margin was sort of 14% 5 years ago. Mm. It's now near 25%.
Yeah.
So by adding software, it vastly improves the quality of the business and should reflect in the share price.
Yeah, I saw they did sign an agreement, didn't they, with Elon Musk's Starlink low orbit satellite. And I guess that is to do sort of automation and that dovetailing integration with the software that I guess it gives you coverage in the rural areas where there's no cell sites.
Well, it's always satellite coverage, you know, but it's just, again, it's to try to detailed mapping, and then they can photograph the results. Mm. And they'll say within certain days, if you plant within certain days, and we can inform the farmer using all the, you know, weather and everything else, and also looking at their site, they can produce much better results than just doing, you know, scattering equally at all times. And, you know, it's like everything, we're using more and more data to improve efficiency.
I'm guessing that's also going to be a massive potential benefit for the whole industry, because one of the bugbears, I guess, of most sort of like farmers, agricultural farmers, has not only been, you know, trying to get the yield up, which is what that technology does, but also just recruiting people to pick the fruit and to pick the grain. And if you've got an autonomous vehicle that can go and do that for you on a remote, you just let it get on, don't you?
I think people sort of, you know, they try hard to find workers and they're tough old jobs out in the fields and very indifferent weather, you know, and they're very hard to find that. And eventually this will be automated, like, you know, more and more jobs that are require sort of PPE or you know, people don't want to do them anymore. So employment is still pretty high, so people can choose. So companies must automate, and John Deere or businesses who identify that and can provide the products should grow faster.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we've just got to run through a whole lot of sort of like GARP and value stocks. Let's go to one which has really knocked the ball out the park. In fact, it's probably gone up more than many of the AI mega caps, which is at Novo Nordisk in healthcare, which is obviously famous for its diabetes franchise, and it's also moved into anti-obesity drugs, these GLP-1s, and I think actually now it's Europe's largest business, but the shares have moonshot. And I guess the question is here is, obviously you've got a major winner that you've benefited over a long term. When do you start trimming to sort of like decide when to sell this thing?
So a great question. You know, we watched this before we bought it. We probably watched this business for about 2 years. That it was a smashing business, but always too expensive. The share price fell about 30 or 40% due to some issues about pricing of diabetes drugs in the US. Yes. We then bought it. And then along came the sort of GLP-1s with semaglutide, which is the molecule that produces as a diabetes drug, but also a weight loss drug. And a good question is, you know, this is one of the most expensive things in the portfolio. So we've just been reducing your position in it.
Yeah.
It's not quite reached a sell yet. And the reason why that is we think forecasts are still too low. Because there is a huge unmet need. I think globally, 450 million people live with diabetes and about 650 million with obesity. So they've hardly touched the marketplace. Mm. And Novo and Lilly are the two sort of first to market, and will capture most of that growth. But you find things like they did a study last year for the major adverse cardiac events of people who are overweight having heart attacks, and they found that if they took, Wegovy, they lost weight and they had 20% fewer heart events. So suddenly you've got another population that isn't just weight loss, but actually is sort of to improve cardiovascular health. You have another sort of 100 or 50 million patients somewhere else. So there still is, I think, more growth in this. It's still the biggest company in Europe, growing by 30% still for the next couple of years. But our position now is a sort of 1.5% position in the portfolio.
Yeah, and now it does seem as though they've got a supply issue, not a demand issue, and I think they're trying to improve or increase production, aren't they? And yeah, you're right. In terms of expanding the therapeutic applications of Wegovy, there's also the chronic kidney disease, isn't it? Because that's associated with diabetes, and it should hopefully.
Yeah, Alzheimer's as well. They're looking at a variety of different targets that this sort of wonder molecule. Plus, they've got another product that they believe will have more weight loss coming out in the next couple of years as well. So there's, it has performed very well, but there's a huge market out there that is currently curtailed by supply, and it will be for several years.
Yeah, well done on that one. Okay, well, let's stick with the healthcare, but move to the other end of the spectrum into sort of like oncology. We've got two, we've got Roche and we've got AstraZeneca, and I guess these companies, obviously, the cancer's continuing to sort of like, unfortunately, afflict lots and lots of the population. But also, you've got, I guess, what you've got now is new technologies for diagnosis to increase the total addressable market. Because if you diagnose people earlier, it means that there'll be greater number of people can benefit from this. Can you take us through? Let's start with Roche, because they came out with sort of flat to mute type of results just recently. Shares have dropped down to pretty low levels, actually. I was just looking at the PE ratio. We're on about 13, I think it is, something like that. And pays a reasonable dividend.
Yeah. And they've grown the dividend for the last 37 years.
Yeah.
So, it's a pretty very progressive dividend policy, and it's very cheap. The issue for Roche has been they used to be the biggest in oncology,
Yeah.
with drugs like Avastin, Herceptin, which have lost patent protection in recent years, and sales have fallen. Their new potential new pipeline, a few drugs have disappointed and have not been approved. So they've sort of lost a bit of the luster that was around the business. This was regarded as a sort of premium business. In their defense, they still have a very strong pipeline of 52 new drugs, as well as sort of line extensions. And they have the biggest business that which also looks at testing. So as you say, that before people say that you have cancer, what type of cancer? What are the certain expressions of genetic expressions? And if they can identify that, you can shape the treatment much more effectively than they could previously. And there's quite a few changes going on there with the tools that the companies can apply. But Roche has all of these tools, and it has a sort of strong pipeline. Often, the question I'm asked by some of our clients is, what is going to be the catalyst for the Roche price to recover? We think it's just good value, and gradually this pipeline will come into new products. And once there's more confidence in that, they should be re-rated. But in the meantime, we've got a low valuation, and I say a dividend that's gone up for the last 37 years and will keep going up.
Yeah, I'll tell you what one catalyst will be is the two rocket ships, Lilly and Novo Nordisk, when they stop going up and sucking out all the healthcare fund managers out from those two stocks and start they look elsewhere. Then, I mean, it's just been a lead balloon. I mean, another one where it's had a lead balloon effect, the GLP-1, is AstraZeneca, which has really has dropped below 100 pence. Well, sorry, 100 pounds now. Yeah. It's trading on about, again, 15 times, which is, it's got a much higher sort of an EPS growth trajectory than most traditional drug companies. So its PEG ratio, I'm guessing, is probably less than one. I don't know. I'd have to look at it. But it's a monster in oncology. Great drugs. And what's your sort of outlook here? Because, again, it looks a bit like Roche all over. It's cheap, long-term.
The reason why we like both Roche and Astra is, unlike some competitors, they have one or two drugs and a very small pipeline.
Yeah.
Both Astra and Roche, I've got a range of therapeutic areas. I mean, sort of Astra has cardiovascular, oncology, immunology, rare diseases. There's a variety of things. But also they've got, currently looking at 27 phase 3 trials. So there's a lot of drugs behind this. And I think they believe that 10 of these could have blockbuster potential, which means sales of over $1 billion. So, you know, the short term, the market was a little bit concerned about rising OPEX, i.e. the cost of bringing new drugs to market. So their operating margin is still a good bit below others in the sector, but they're focusing on getting product to market and driving sales growth. And there we think the opportunity is still a huge one.
Yeah. Oh, but I'm with you. I think both Roche and AstraZeneca are cracking healthcare companies for long-term sort of defensive type of investors who just wants good dividends and capital appreciation multi-decade, because they're in the right places at the right time. Okay, well, let's
applying huge technology. I mean, there's sort of there's a variety of whether it's sort of T cells and the ADCs, how to identify and treat cancers, which will transform therapies in the next, you know, 5 and 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, I'm pretty sure cancer, oncology, et cetera, is going to take another step up in terms of demand once they can successfully and accurately diagnose people with early stage cancer. It's going to hugely increase the total addressable market, because most of these immunotherapies at the moment are only used for stage 4 patients rather than stage 1, 2, or 3, because you can't diagnose these guys. But we're on a cusp of doing that. We're not far. Okay. Well, let's move on to another sector. We've got decarbonisation, which again comes back to a similar sort of theme, I think, with, you know, sort of, you know, moving to electrification. We've got Johnson Matthey, which used to be a real darling of the UK stock market about 10, 15 years ago. Yeah. It's a trade on about 20, 30 times PE now it's less than 10 times. It does. It's sort of like synonymous with all things catalytic converter and reducing emissions. But clearly investors don't like it. But I guess your fund still thinks it's good value, yeah?
We think there's a lot of technology here. Yeah. And they are sort of leaders in surface chemistry, and they employ lots of, you know, PhDs who work very closely with their customers. So relationships are pretty sticky. Why it has been derated is it was, as you say, a leader in clean air, which was about providing, you know, catalysts for the automotive sector. Certainly with EVs do not require exhausts, so this was definitely a threat to the business. What has happened is that the growth in EVs has actually been slower than we've anticipated, but also regulations for, even if it's, you know, hybrids, petrol or diesel, authorities wish to have cleaner air, and therefore they have more complex catalysts. But it's not really a growth area because of the growth in EVs. So, you know, this has been a sort of slow decline, which doesn't lead to a high rating. Their challenge has been to develop other areas of growth. And they try to build a sort of a more efficient cathode for electric vehicles, which they pulled because they didn't see the return. And investors are wondering sort of how they make up for the decline in clean air. There are a few things, but still relatively small. One is they are the leader in platinum group materials. So platinum's been used for many catalysts, but also for this helps with the production of other fuels, which have huge potential is. For it's green hydrogen, for example, which will, but it's still relatively small. They are winning some big contracts for this, but until investors have more confidence of the transition from clean air to, I guess, hydrogen or catalysts, the rating is going to be under pressure. But we think it's a high quality business, and it's really, that's not priced into the shares at all.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd say it looks like an acquisition target to me. Somebody's going to take these guys out.
there is a large equity. There's a large sort of hedge fund in there already.
Really? I'm not surprised.
The market has done nothing with it.
Yeah.
Share price has responded.
Yeah. Well, I may join you as a shareholder on that one. Okay. Well, let's move to mining. We've just got Glencore, which isn't the archetypal decarbonisation because it's big into sort of like coal, but it does a bit of copper and it does trading as well. But it trades at, I mean, obviously had a good year in 2021 during the lockdowns, had a bit of life. It trades at, well, about 10 times forward earnings, but plays a 7% dividend yield. Can you tell us what was your sort of attraction to this one?
So, we don't necessarily rule companies out because they don't have the best ESG ratings, yeah. But we look for companies who are trying to improve them. And while Glencore still has coal, we believe it will manage its coal resources efficiently and responsibly. But it also has other factors which will benefit from growth in electric vehicles, electrification, things like, you know, copper, nickel, and other alloys, which have real long-term growth. The sector will have to invest more, so it'll be a bit over the relatively short term, investors have been more concerned about demand from China, and pricing has been weak and the share price has come back. But long term demand, you know, this business is very well pleased with its assets. Yeah. When demand picks up again, as you say, the yield's very attractive, mm-hmm. and it does throw off lots of cash.
Yeah, well, you'll get paid back your investment within a few years at that dividend rate, no doubt about it. Now, what about in oil and gas? You've got Chevron. Now, the question, I guess, it just bought, I think, Hess in an all-stocks transaction, $53 billion, to get control of that Guyana asset, I think, largely, that they have. Can you tell us just what sort of attracts you to those integrated oil, particularly why you've gone US rather than sort of a Shell or a BP, which is actually on a cheaper valuation?
Yeah. One of the reasons why we like Chevron so much is their number one priority is to grow the dividend, maintain the dividend. So you've had it historically, when the times are good, BP, Royal Dutch, they invest very heavily. When things turn down, they cut capex and they cut the dividend. So we believe that Chevron takes a much longer term approach to its assets. It has a good mix of short term assets like shale. Mm. But also sort of long-term assets in, gas assets in Australia, and with the acquisitions, are really long-term assets. But the fact that they look through the cycle and invest through the cycle has resulted in having much better longer-term returns than Royal Dutch or BP.
Yeah, that's a sort of like a sleep safely at night type stock, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, well, let's move to technology, but more on the sort of the GARP value side rather than the Mag 7. Yeah. We've got to Intel, which actually used to be a darling, then came back and was sledged, but it's got a new sort of like CEO who started turning it around. And this is obviously one of the world's leader of CPUs, sort of like, you know, chips for PCs and for servers, rather than your GPUs, which is your NVIDIAs and your AMDs, and it isn't into mobile, I don't think, with things like ARM, etc. But it's moving into sort of the foundry. Can you take us what sort of attracted you to here? Because it's doubled, actually, in the last 12 months, or near enough doubled.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. We'll say, if you're looking at areas that are out of favour, there's more chances of finding some value.
Yeah.
You know, rather than chasing what everybody else is. And, you know, while the NVIDIA having the sort of the hottest chips today, this is likely to lead to a whole new replacement cycle as we have more and more AI chips nearer the customer, i.e. on the PC, on the servers, everything else. And Intel, there's more and more using data in everything we do now, from, you know, smart fridges, the processing in vehicles, and Intel will be a longer term beneficiary of that. the challenge is for them to sort of really catch up, because TSCM has driving down the sort of the size and power of chips, and Intel are trying hard to catch up, but seem to be making some progress, which is not yet reflected in their share price.
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be. I think that's what, you know, people have been fixated about near-term AI, but actually AI at the edge is going to be really huge, isn't it? Because at the moment, we've just had the picks and shovels, get the infrastructure GPU'd, get the large language models in so they can sell it. Now you're starting subscription, get the subscription models from the likes of Microsoft, which should drive user usage at the edge, which is going to require faster CPUs, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the...
Yeah. It'll take a bit of time, but that's where the big differences will actually, for us, will be employed, you know, having it closer at the edge, as you say.
Yeah. And is that sort of also the sort of theme behind some... You've got Dell in your portfolio as well, which obviously is to do, you know, traditional sort of PCs and make sort of like servers, but has also moved into sort of like data storage, cloud computing and cybersecurity, I'm guessing. Is it similar sort of theme, is it?
So that's sort of a variety of sort of great long-term themes of, you know, cybersecurity, you know, data storage, you know, cloud servers. But also, I mean, Dell has if you go back for 20 years, this was a big name. We disappeared for probably the last 15 years, but it has a tremendous supply chain organization.
Yeah.
And again, as we have more and more of these sort of AI chips, this will go into, you know, servers, it'll go into PCs, and Dell will be a major beneficiary of that. So it's still pretty attractive valuation, and nothing like the valuation attracted to some other parts of this.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, well, it's just the final one on the sort of value, sort of growth tech is Cisco, which I guess you weren't piling into in 2000 when it was on a PE ratio of 300 plus, but it's now dropped down to about 15, 16, and it's just made a big acquisition of Splunk, which is more sort of recurring revenue software on top. And it's been seen to be moving this transition from its traditional sort of networking equipment into software and services like cybersecurity, but also now obviously in big data. Can you just take through, I guess it's probably a similar sort of theme. It's going to be a beneficiary of when things move out to the edge.
You know, sort of all the sort of Cisco's a very vital hardware to how it's all brought together, combining it with additional services, security, you know, networking, adds a lot of value, and they've got a very strong market position, and we believe, you know, that the growth is a great, you know, it will again benefit from as we need to sort of, you know, globally pick up the quality and speed of our systems, but also maintaining high levels of security. And Cisco is a clear beneficiary at an attractive price.
Yeah, and I guess because it's US, then people can trust it with their data when it comes to sort of the West, rather than, because it's Huawei's one of their big telco equipment networking competitors, and I can't see the UK government putting more Huawei into its backbone network.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, great. Well, let's move to banks. These have been absolutely, you know, they've in the doghouse for years. We've got HSBC and UBS. Can you talk through HSBC? Because obviously that's used to be the world's local global bank or something like that, didn't it? It's massive, obviously, in Hong Kong and Asia and China, and also got a big business in the UK as well. Trades at, 10, 15% discount to net tangible book. So it's certainly not expensive.
Yeah. To sort of, we're very wary of combining cyclicality with leverage. So the banks that we invest in always have surplus capital. And in fact, in the last week, we've had two of our banks, Handelsbanken and DBS, pay special dividends. We think HSBC will also pay a special dividend this year. Why we looked at HSBC again was that after sort of many years, HSBC was a relatively poor performer, had a variety of assets in parts of the world which never made a profit. And despite talking about rationalising them, they did nothing about it. There was a change in management about 3-4 years ago, and things started to change. A much greater focus on costs. They sold off their French business, and they're also selling off their business in Canada to the Royal Bank of Canada. And that will have a sort of probably a special dividend or share buyback as a result of it. The attraction for HSB longer term is it is a sort of leading global bank, will benefit from improving trade, but is very well placed in Hong Kong, China, where they still have issues with some of the other domestic banks, but also there's a huge opportunity for wealth management, as customers become a bit wealthier, looking after their assets, their pensions, and HSBC is very, very well placed. And when it trades at a discount to tangible book, many of the US competitors trade at multiples of book. Plus, HSBC has an attractive dividend and has bought back $7 billion of shares last year. So it's a financially very strong bank.
Yeah, well, I mean, it isn't just as attractive dividend. It's a dividend monster, isn't it? Yeah. It pays like an 8% dividend, which is just...
Which they had been sort of, they have a sort of loan deposit ratio of less than 70%. Yeah. So historically, with zero interest rates, they had 30% of the deposits earning virtually nothing. But of course, once you know US rates go up, that transforms their revenue. And you know, I think the sort of rates will be in a reasonable place for quite some time. So it's well placed.
Yeah, well, when you next speak to the board, make sure you tell them, from me as a customer, they need to upgrade their IT systems because that is just a painful process at the moment. They're very trustworthy, but when it comes to sort of like IT, they're not spearheading the changes at the moment.
Well, when I last met them was that I assumed banks would be able to reduce their costs much more. Mm. Because as more and more transactions are now digital transactions, doesn't involve you and me going into a branch with cash. Mm. They said around sort of 90-95% of transactions are now digital, but around 65% of costs are to do with non-digital transactions, which is extraordinary. Yeah. So there's still a huge opportunity for banks to improve their efficiency. But all banks, and HSBC is one of the biggest banks in the world, are spending billions on their IT apps to improve efficiency. But there's a huge opportunity for them if they can do that.
Yeah, well, it'd be lovely for me, that's for sure. I could do with that. Okay, well, another one which is a beneficiary of the move to wealth management, i.e., with HSBC in Asia, is UBS, because obviously it's just bought Credit Suisse, and also I guess there's lots of upside of just stripping out a shed load of costs because it's huge duplication with regards to Credit Suisse, which is just bought. Sorry, and can you just take us through this one? It trades at round about. I think about net assets at the moment.
I think it's a huge opportunity. I mean, the attraction for UBS isn't as a bank; it's about a global wealth manager, and they've been growing very, very strongly. They currently have around $3 trillion in assets, but there are areas like the leader number one in Asia, Latin America, Switzerland. And emerging markets around Asia. For those who are wealthy, we'd like to have their assets managed probably offshore with a bank that you can trust. And UBS is phenomenally placed. We were a little bit, initially concerned about the acquisition of Credit Suisse, because Credit Suisse had a large investment bank and it was pretty badly managed. It used to always set low targets, which they failed to meet. UBS have done a tremendous job in the last 12 months of putting the business together and taking costs out and streamlining it. And I think this shouldn't be rated as a bank. It should be rated as a high fast growth wealth manager, and they expect, I think, net growth of at least 100 billion of net to new money for the next 2 years, and then perhaps they expect, they're forecasting 200 billion of net new money thereafter, which is pretty punchy growth on still a very low valuation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people say sort of some of the smart money's in the bond market, and they've just sold, I think, some 81 bonds actually last week, and they're raising a couple of billion euros or something like that, and the order book was over 12 billion, which just says to everything that actually there's a lot of people who want to invest in this business because it's got an attractive self-help strategy, hasn't it? Okay, well, let's move on to the final sector. We've got media advertising and sort of information partners. We've got Relex, which is formerly the Reed Elsevier, which does sort of like a B2B services, information in science and technology and medical publishing, and it's sort of like compliance and regulation. Can you just take us through this one? Because it does still make extremely attractive margins. I mean, EBIT of over 30%. It isn't that cheap, but it's I guess it's one a pretty unique asset.
Also, been sort of they've been sort of doing AI for the last 10 years.
Yeah,
and investors first saw this as a threat, and now see it as an opportunity for them because they use their data analytics for an insurance business, and by using the most technology, they're able to take market share and grow, but also in their a huge position in the legal marketplace, and again that's much more online, and by using their searches and also in academia, there's pretty assured growth. Yeah. So it's a high multiple, but it's a high margin business, and it's steady above market growth, and we expect that to continue.
Yeah, would you consider top slicing this one? Because I mean, it is on a sort of like a 27 times PE at all.
Yeah, well, it hasn't reached our sell yet.
Yeah,
but new money isn't going into Relex, so we tend to buy the ones that are cheaper.
Yeah,
and reduce the ones that are more expensive. It's a crazy strategy, but
well, you've raised a really good point actually, because the world has been addicted to passives and ETF trackers. And that's their modus operandi, isn't it? They effectively buy high and sell low.
That's when they buy more of the biggest companies. You want to buy more of the cheapest companies. Right. And when they become expensive, you should be reducing them. But that's the opposite of what trackers are doing.
Yeah, I know.
And I think this market just now, in several areas, is incredibly concentrated, with the big five or big seven driving a huge part of the returns. And if you're more optimistic, you would expect this to widen as we become more confident about economic growth recovering.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, broadening the index, no doubt about it. Okay, well, the final stock in sort of classic advertising agency is Interpublic US. And I guess the question is, why sort of like traditional sort of, you know, advertising agencies? And second is, why Interpublic instead of, say, WPP or Publicis, isn't it, is its main competitor?
I think it's obviously still a market for advertising,
yeah.
But I think we liked it to public because it was a leader into sort of data analytics. So using much more of the internet and sales and looking at sales effectiveness. And if you can do that more effectively, it certainly adds value to your customers. So it's a strong market position, pretty big barriers to entry. And I think they're in the sort of the data part, which is the fastest growing part of advertising.
Yeah, they won't be sort of disintermediated at all by the likes of, you know, regenerative AI when it moves from search to discovery and obviously Meta and Google, etc.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's one of my biggest sort of frustrations is that, you know, given that sort of, Google and will always say, we'll use AI, but when you search for anything, you never find. They know what they're looking for, but they always give you three other things you don't want, first of all, because, so how does that work with AI? So, you know, I think there's a slightly different parts to it, but I think that Interpublic helped the companies be identified, but also they have the campaigns that bring the customers in the first place, and that's not really in Google's job.
Yeah, I guess it's more sort of demand pull rather than actually supply push, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Well, what? Just thanks for that. Well, just sort of the end of it. What one things which is quite sort of like what picks out? You see, there aren't that many consumer stocks in your portfolio. Yeah. Although I think you've got Danone in there, but the vast sort of like, you know, your B2B. Is that sort of like a strategy you've been employing? Because obviously, consumer is 70% or 60% of the Western economy.
Yeah, good point. You know, historically, when the fund was launched in 2011, we owned things like Nestle, you know, McDonald's, you know, Colgate, Diageo, and they're, you know, pretty strong businesses, but they actually didn't grow as fast as we expected, and we had all that the zero interest rate and people looking at the sort of bond proxies, and the multiples of these businesses went higher despite their growth not really doing very much. And often, you know, they haven't grown very as much as you would have expected over the last 5 years, but the multiples are still too high for us. And and also we find that the consumer is still suffering from higher interest rates, higher mortgage payments. And while they're in a relatively good place with high employment and consumer savings, it's still a tough area to be. Yeah. And at the margins, we're seeing some signs of customers being more price sensitive and trading down, which is hitting these businesses like Diageo. So we've invested where the money is, which is in the corporates who have the cash in the bank and who will invest in, you know, we think corporate capex, which we see as being a sort of, after sort of years of decline, will be a strong theme for the next, you know, 5 and 10 years as businesses improve efficiency, energy efficiency, and also automation and use AI.
Yeah, well, that's a really critical point. I think investors need to sort of like, you know, sort of sink in on, because a pricing power going forward is going to be essential. If you're onto secular tailwinds, you should retain a lot of the pricing power. But if you're a consumer facing sort of FMCG business that has been benefiting from extreme pricing increases over the last 2 or 3 years as inflation, but when inflation now drops down and they can't, and consumers are down trading, they will get presumably margin compression, won't they, I imagine?
An example, even again, which is a bit more consumer facing, were investors in Michelin, who a couple of years ago, I heard the finance director complain about, we've had pressure on rubber price, pressure on steel price. We couldn't get a container, we couldn't get a ship, and once it was delivered to Europe, we couldn't get a driver to deliver it. I said, but your margin's gone up from 11 to 12%. How did you manage that? I said, well, we put our prices up 5 times.
Yeah.
So businesses that have pricing power and pricing leadership can do relatively well. And as they're investing in the right area, you know, with less parts of, you know, rubber particles or vehicles, all these sorts of things, there's faster growth than the sector if they can identify the trends and also invest in them and take market share.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to the day I can buy a Magnum ice cream at the corner shop for less than £3. So that'll be a big plus to me. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Graham, for all the brilliant insights. If people want to invest in your River Global funds, how best to do that?
Every platform. The fund is called WS Saracen Global Income and Growth. Mm-hmm. We are owned by River, and eventually the name will change, but currently it's WS Saracen Global Income and Growth, and we're on every platform, there'll be, if any questions, please look at our website and we can adjust you to who's the best person for you to speak to.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again. It's been a real breath of fresh air. You're the first sort of global equity fund manager I've come across who's absolutely stuck to their knitting and not been sucked into this, you know, sort of like trend of quasi tracking. So absolutely terrific insight. So thanks very much, Graham, and hopefully we look forward in chatting base going forward.
Thanks for all your questions. Thank you. All the best. Bye bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.